There's a sutta where the Buddha gives a very extended analogy for the practice. It starts out with a man being presented with four vipers. He's told he has to care for them, feed them, bathe them, lift them up, put them back to sleep. And you have to do this time and again, they say. And if any of these vipers gets provoked with you, you'll meet with death or death-like pain. So the man runs away. And then he's told that five murderers are following him right on his heels, with the thought that whenever they can catch up with him, they'll kill him. So he runs away even more. Then he's told there's a sixth murderer, someone who used to be an intimate companion, but now is ready to slice off his head. He's already got his sword raised. He gets into a village. It's empty. So he goes around, as people would do in those days, to check out what treasures they might find in the empty village. But everything he looks at is totally empty, void, hollow. Every house is empty, void, hollow. Every pot is empty, and void, and hollow. He's told that there are village-attacking bandits that are about to attack the village. So again, he has to run away. He finally gets to a stream. He sees that this shore is dangerous, but the other shore is safe. But he has to cross the stream. So he does that by putting together a raft and using his hands and feet to swim. He gets across to the other side, finally to safety. The four vipers stand for the four properties of the body. The five thieves, of course, are the five aggregates. The sixth one is passion and delight. It's ready to cut off your head. It's something intimate. It's going to cut off your head at any time, though. The empty village stands for the sense organs. The bandits that are attacking the village stand for the objects of the senses. The raft stands for the Eightfold Path, and the far shore, of course, stands for nirvana. The near shore stands for self-identity. Everything you identify with is there. And the five aggregates and the four elements, the sense spheres, everything that's you or yours. You create your self-identity out of that. But notice that that stream that you cross, it's not a smooth lake. It's got a strong current. It stands for the what they call the fourfold flood. It's the flood of sensuality, the flood of views, the flood of becoming, and the flood of ignorance. In other words, as you practice the path, it's very easy to get swept away by any of these things. So don't think that when you sit here with your eyes closed, you'll just float your way over to nirvana. The dangers are not only on this shore, they're also on the river that you have to cross. So these are some of the things you have to watch out for. The flood of sensuality. You sit here and all of a sudden you can think of all the different sensual pleasures you'd like to get engaged in, things you're missing right now. And you can embroider them with all kinds of details that make them appealing. What you'll notice in all these sensual, as the Buddha calls them, sensual resolves. I mean, your plans. You'd like this, you'd like that. And you can cook up all kinds of narratives around how nice it would be to get this pleasure, how nice it would be to get that pleasure. And it pulls you away. That's one thing that keeps you from getting across to the other shore. The antidote there, of course, is to look at the downside of those pleasures. First, just look at how much your sensual pleasures and plans are lying to you. There's that great story with the John Lee talking about when he was a young monk and he was feeling tempted to disrobe, and so he goes up into an empty spot in the jetty there at Wat Saprotum in Bangkok. He makes his plans, how he's going to disrobe, what it's going to be like. And at first the story is just really amazing. He gets an ideal wife and he gets a good job. Gets a kid. But then reality sets in. The wife is not all that healthy. After all, she came from a fine background. She's not used to having to work. She dies. And things just go downhill from there to the point where he says, I wish I hadn't disrobed. Then he runs and says, I haven't disrobed. Here I am. But simply being truthful to himself, he began to realize that the sensual pleasures he was planning and thinking about, all that activity was a lie. Notice when the Buddha is talking about sensuality, it's not the objects that are the problem. It's the stories that we like to create. We're just really, really attached to our story making. But still, we have to look at the downside, and that includes looking at the downsides of the objects. The human body is number one sensual attraction. We start out being attracted to our own bodies, attached to them. And then from there we go on to other people's bodies. So we have to turn around and look at our body. This is why the Buddha has that meditation on the 32 parts of the body. Where he had 31, the commentary added another one. And they're not just 32, there are a lot of parts that are missing in the list, and you can add any parts that you like that help remind you that this body you've got here. If you take it apart and look at all the different parts, you find it pretty disgusting. The clothing you use, if you wore it for several days at a time, you couldn't stand it. You'd have to wash it. And it's not from the dust outside, it's from all the sweat and other stuff that comes out of the body. So this is one of the weapons you use against that flood of sensuality that comes on you when you're sitting here and meditating. Then there's the flood of views. Number one is, what are you doing here sitting here just doing nothing with your mind? Can't you be doing something more creative? Okay, what about the creations? And what is this voice? Where is it pushing? Where is it coming from? All kinds of views that could get you to give up the practice. Especially those of us born in the West. Lots of other cultural values pushing us away from the Dharma, pushing us away from really trying to look deeply into ourselves. We've got a lot of those voices, and they've got lots of arguments. But don't think that people raised in Buddhist countries don't have similar problems. They've just got different voices, different ways of getting pulled away from the practice based on views of one kind or another. So you've got to have good arguments against them. If they're going to be stubborn, you have to be stubborn too. Sometimes they refuse to divulge, why would you say that? You say, I'm not going to listen to you until you give me a good reason. And they'll try to push you, they'll yell at you, they'll get into your breath, and then they'll get from there into the hormones in the body and make it seem like you can't stand to sit here. But you've just got to be stubborn. Say, I need a good reason for why I should stop. And ask yourself, when they give the reason, is this going to take you any place you've never been before? The meditation promises to take you all the way to the other side of the river where you've never been. And the people who stand there, they're reliable people. This is one of the reasons why the Ajahns in Thailand stress so much the teaching on practicing the Dharma in accordance with the Dharma, not in accordance with your views. There's so many people in the West that say, the Buddha says, well, trust yourself, rely on yourself, don't believe anything you don't already agree with. He never really said that. He said you have to test things for yourself, but you also have to take into consideration the counsel of the wise, because after all, your perceptions can really be skewed. Especially around the issue of sensuality, there's that great passage where he talks about the leper. The leper sits there and takes a stick, sticks it in the fire, and then when the stick is nice and hot, cauterizes his wounds. Because it feels good. Why does it feel good? Because, as the Buddha said, his perceptions are skewed. If he were actually cured of leprosy, would he take a stick, put it in the fire, and stick it on his skin? No way. And does it really help his wounds? His wounds just get more and more festered. feels good for a bit, but it's bad down the line. And again, it's all because of his skewed perception. He said, this is what people who attach to sensuality are like. And only if you're beyond sensuality can you say you really can trust yourself. This is why we need guidance. When the Buddha talks about taking yourself as your refuge, he immediately says, take the Dharma as a refuge. He equates the two. That means turning yourself into Dharma. Taking the Dharma as your pattern for who you want to be. That, of course, connects with the third flood, which is becoming the sort of person you want to be, the sort of world you want to inhabit. Do you want to inhabit the world of artists? Do you want to inhabit the world of lawyers? Do you want to inhabit the world of whatever? At the very least, the Buddha says, you can take on the identity of a meditator. Be a good meditator. But watch out for what happens when you get tied up in your self-identity. There's that really fine passage where he talks about the person of integrity who practices as opposed to the person of no integrity. The person of no integrity is constantly comparing himself to other people. If his virtues are better than others, he exalts himself over that. If he lives in the forest, and whatever his ascetic practice, he exalts himself over that. Okay, that's a person of no integrity. You can do the things, you can do the practices, you can even get in the very, very high stages of jhana and still be a person of no integrity. Because you're constantly building a sense of self around this that you then use as a bludgeon against other people. Or even if you just think it, I'm better than those people there, you've missed the whole point. As the Buddha says, the person of integrity is one who realizes that even if you've attained something like this, so soon as you start building an identity around it, the basis has already changed. You build a basis around a nice state of concentration and start getting proud of it, the concentration's gone. The value of that practice is gone. So you have to be very careful. You have to learn how not to create a sense of self, of your identity around these things. That's how you get to the other shore. There can be a provisional sense as you gain the pride that comes from just mastering things. But when you start comparing yourself to other people, that's when it gets bad. So watch out for that flood. And then it's fine, the flood of ignorance, which covers all the other things that are going to come washing over you as you practice. You've got to stand firm. Keep paddling away. You hold on to the raft. Of course, we know that once you get to the other side, you can let go of the raft. But while you're practicing, you've got to hold on to your concentration. If it starts seeming dumb to be sitting here and not thinking anything, remember, it's a skill. It needs to be protected. You have to watch out. There's that phrase when the Buddha talks about protecting your mindfulness by putting aside greed and distress with reference to the world. Okay, there are lots of things out there in the world that are going to pull you away, say, this would be better, that would be better, or this is something you want to get upset about. You have to learn how to inure yourself against these things, protect yourself. And that's a skill. It requires questioning all the values you've picked up from the world. That's how you make yourself your own refuge, your own island, by making everything, all the aggregates that you usually use to make your sense of self, make them into the path. And that's what will get you over to the other side. So you have to realize that even though there are lots of dangers on this shore, and you don't want to stay here, still you're going to have to face a lot of dangers as you practice, things that will pull you away. They'll pull you back to the shore, carry you down to the, as the Buddha said, the rapids and the whirlpools. of sensuality, becoming, views, ignorance. So you always have to be vigilant as you practice. Don't think as soon as you propose the idea of the committee of the mind, hey, let's meditate, that everybody in the committee will say, yes, that sounds great. Because we've all had opposition in our committees. The important thing is to realize that you don't have to identify with the opposition. It is normal. As the Buddha said, these currents are strong, but they can be overcome. There is that safe shore. And all the people who get there were people on this shore before. It's just not like they were born superhuman. Simply that they had a really strong sense of the dangers here and a willingness to face the dangers that you encounter in the past. And with the support from the Buddha, we talk about taking our refuge in ourselves, and at the same time taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha. It's all the same thing, because you take them as examples that you want to emulate. Without the examples, where would you gain any idea of how to do this? This is why the Buddha said that the whole of the practice is admirable friendship. It's not the admirable friend is going to do it for you, but it's because we have the Buddha as an admirable friend that we know that this can be done. And we have guidance. We have the Sangha to show that the Buddha wasn't the only person who could do it. So make yourself a member of the Noble Sangha. That's where all these versions of refuge come together.